This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
So I was called in by the sommelier from the White House saying that they wanted to taste some of my wines. There's a little bit of history that they knew some of the wines that I was making back on the days for a company that I used to work. And so on top of it, they got to taste it and they like it and they feature it for years. And so, I mean, can I feel more proud than my wine is being served to the president? You cannot be. I mean, it's just a joy.
That was Alex Sotelo, Mexican-American winemaker, whose wine was featured in the White House for years. He's someone who has worked his way up the crooked rungs of an incredibly long ladder, driven not by some promised and guaranteed goal, but instead the belief that the only way forward is hand over hand, pull after pull. That experience mirrors that of many immigrants who come to the United States. Making a new life isn't easy, especially when there's no simple mold to fit into. There's no, oh, slot A goes into tab B here, and then voila, you have a perfectly molded new life. Alex said it in our previous episode, and I'm saying it again. The American dream, it is hard work. Hello, this is the second episode of The Pendatang Cometh, a four-parter attempting to gain some understanding of what it means to be an immigrant by delving into the story of a country built on the waves of people crossing its borders, America. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Last week, we looked at the stories of how and why people arrived in the States. This week, it's about what happens when they get there. Take Tisha Gomez, for instance. You heard from her briefly last week, but it's time to get better acquainted. Tisha currently works at the Center for International Studies at MIT, but her time in the U.S. began when she arrived in the 80s and somehow managed to work two jobs.
I would do babysitting, and on the weekends I would clean hotel rooms. And it was right in the beginning, my English was not good yet. I could communicate, but, you know, a lot of gestures and things like that. So language was a major impediment for me to get a better job.
Surmount the language gap.
Coming in here, one of the things that I did, and I was unconscious of it, but it was good for me, was that I immersed myself with the native speakers. Most of the immigrants, when they come here and they have trouble with the language, they tend to stay together, work together, live together. And that was not my case. I lived with Brazilians, but I only worked with Americans.
While also putting herself through college. As you might have gathered, she is a force to be reckoned with.
I was working first with children because it was easy to learn with them and with the parents. But as the years passed and my English improved, I started taking courses on the community college close to where I worked. From there, I was babysitting this family, and the lady, she had gone to Wellesley College, and she said, maybe you should try Wellesley. I think that would be a good fit for you. And I thought, of course, that was just a dream. But she was really pushing me to apply and everything. So I applied. I was accepted. I graduated in 1998. 2 years later, it was a friend from Wellesley, who told me about this opening at the Center for International Studies at MIT. I graduated in political science and economics, so it was a good match for what I wanted to do and where I wanted to be. My first day at MIT was quite of an eventful day. It was September 11, 2001.
That point about education is an important one. Rafael Rios, another Mexican-American winemaker in the Valley, who's also an attorney, presses this home.
When we were, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old, we had to work. So weekends, holidays, sometimes after school, he would take us out to the vineyard to help him. It was very difficult. You know, the work was very hard. It's partly what just made me decide that I wanted to go to school because I didn't want to do that type of labor. Working in the vineyards, I particularly remember some days where in the springtime, early spring, we were out on weekends in the mornings very early, you know, get out to the vineyard by about 7 o'clock in the morning. And it was very cold. The grass still had ice on it, and Some of my most vivid memories about that was walking through the frozen grass, you know, in the morning before it warmed up and my toes hurting so much from the cold. All of that made me decide that I wanted to go to school.
Alex was another who put himself through community college and worked his way up towards becoming a winemaker on his own. Most of us talk a pretty good game about trying to balance time, but for a new immigrant trying to get through school, it's not actually about balance, but about sacrifice.
It's simple as this, right? One class of school a week is 3 hours, 3-4 hours a week, right? If you need to feed a family, either you're going to school or you're working 3 or 4 hours. If you're not making enough, you need to work for those 3 or 4 hours. So you don't have the time to go to school. Basically, it's the economics. And I was lucky enough that I was single, that I was young, that I got a capability of just support myself, and then I can let go 3-4 hours before I knew I was letting go 10, 15 hours a week. And so it's an investment. But some people don't have the capability of making that investment.
When we met Alex, it was in a lovely house with an extensive wine cellar locked away in a Napa Valley cul-de-sac. From all outside appearances, it looks like a good life, but it's hard fought.
In my classes in college, I was either the only or one out of two Hispanics in my whole class, right? He was white predominant, and he was a little bit sad. But also, I have a certain responsibility that I could not drop out, that I needed to do better, and I needed to do better than average. Because people will look at you and say, well, maybe you don't even belong here. Because numbers show that you don't usually belong there, right? It's and then you have to do a little better and to prove not yourself, but actually it's almost your responsibility.
Winemaking is only one very small part of what many Mexicans are coming to the States to do, but it's as good a place as any to start. Rafael thinks there is a slow but sure recognition that is important.
There wasn't much respect paid to the farm workers. Lately, there's a recognition that really good wine comes from the grapes, from the vineyard. You've got to have the best grapes you possibly can, which includes, you know, the growing of it, the training of the vines, and all the work that has to be put in the vineyard that's being done by the Mexican laborers has a lot to do with it. The job really is a skilled labor that has to be performed.
Napa is also on track to becoming the Bay Area's first majority Latino county, which sounds momentous, but what does it mean really?
There's still a lot of people out there, some who have become citizens and still haven't registered to vote. The economics of the county are such that the power, whether economic or by vote, still will, for some time, reside with what will become the minority. For all the new immigrants and those moving here, it's very difficult. I read a study that was done a couple years ago, I think, it said just to live in Napa, the minimum you have to make, you know, in a year is like $85,000. And, you know, most of the jobs, the hospitality jobs, restaurant jobs, they're not making that. I don't know really how they're surviving making $25,000 to $36,000 a year.
Alex, at least, fully grasps the importance of his vote.
You are responsible to elect your officials. And you are responsible to come to them also, to tell them what is it that you need from them. Because actually they're getting paid by your taxes, by your investment, by your everything. And actually by becoming U.S. citizen, you become part of the community in a more integrated way. It's important to become part of the system.
And that, I think, is a key point in all of this. You come to another country, you try to make it your home, working backbreakingly hard to make that happen. But does it mean anything if the system fails to acknowledge your contributions? Up next, from the micro to the macro, the economics of immigration. You're listening to the Pandatang Kamath, BFM 89.9.
So in the U.S., the immigration debate has been incredibly ideological for very long, and all the attempts to try to reform the immigration system, which everybody agrees is outdated, is inadequate, is slow, but nobody agrees on how to reform it. I think that a little bit more pragmatism, so in this I think the economist can inject a good dose of realism in the debate, saying let's look at the benefits of reforming this system from even just starting an economic point of view, which would be large.
Hello, this is episode 2 of The Pandatang Cometh. I'm Lee Chui Lin, playing tour guide through the twists and turns of immigration with the United States as our looking glass. Today, it's about the economics of being an immigrant. The first half of the show was all about the hard work it takes to chisel away at sculpting your own version of the American dream. Now, I want to look at what it means for a country to take in millions of new people. Giovanni Perry, professor of economics at UC Davis, starts us off.
Most of the evidence that economists have researched indicates that immigration has been absorbed by the U.S. labor market remarkably well, and most immigrants have jobs, are employed.
Now, one contention that comes up a lot is that migrants cost Americans wages.
And the impact on wages and employment of native worker is small. Most studies find that there is not a very large impact on wages. If anything, maybe a little positive on wage of highly skilled and zero on wage of low-skilled, low-educated American. And similarly, not very big impact on employment. So the idea is that immigrants have been absorbed by the American labor market without very much of an impact on labor market outcomes of native workers.
Those aren't the only, some would say, issues, others would cry myths, that come up.
First of all, there is a lot of just mythology out there. I think the economic basis for the reasoning is a very simple economic model, which says that if the labor supply increases and labor demand does not change, then this will put pressure on wages down. So this is a very static and very simplistic model, and a lot of recent research has shown that in an environment where the economy grows, and in an environment where workers are different from each other, they have different skills.
This is true, it would seem, even taking into account differing skill levels.
Actually, the inflow of workers which have some particular skills, in particular, certainly the highly educated and the highly skilled, but also workers that do jobs which are different and they are not done so much by Americans anymore, this inflow can actually help. This worker can be complement rather than competitor to native workers. And firms respond to the inflow of immigrant worker by investing, by expanding, and by growing. So in a growing economy, that static model, it can be very misleading. And evidence is that the U.S. labor market has been developing and has been absorbing, and these workers create opportunities for firms. And so sometimes they push firms to create jobs. This is the channel through which they have an actually positive impact on firm productivity and on growth. So the simple idea that there are N jobs, and if one job is taken by an immigrant, is not taken by a native, does not account for the fact that job grows, that technology changes, and immigrants contribute to this growth and this change, and so they themselves generate opportunities.
So the idea here, I think, is a variant of if you build it, they will come, or more accurately, if they come, jobs will be created. It's just what happens. But to George Borjas, a Cuban immigrant, Harvard professor, and the leading scholar in his field of immigration and economics, the truth instead is this. Immigrants hurt the economic prospects of the Americans they're in competition with, particularly poorer Americans. You can find arguments, really, that land with almost equal weight on either side of that argument, and here's one from Professor Perry.
His focus on the idea that immigrants are not good for low skill because of competition, I would say is based on that simple labor demand static model that I discussed earlier. The recent empirical evidence does not seem to bear this. There is very little evidence of this negative effect, even for low-skilled. I would say at the very least, most of the evidence shows that there is very weak effect on wages of low-skilled. If immigrants, say, do a manual job in agriculture, in the U.S. there is no agricultural job anymore, which is done by a native, no manual job. But farm can hire immigrant in manual job, and then farm grow, and farm also need supervisors, they also need salespeople, they also need managers. And these people are Americans, are U.S. born. So in this more dynamic and complementary environment, I think you see more the beneficial effect.
Beyond what it means for the workers in a country, does immigration help a country grow beyond just swelling population numbers?
I would say that for the U.S. and for several other countries, Canada, Australia, immigration has certainly been one of the very important engines of growth.
That's not to say that there aren't countries that haven't been able to grow without the help of migrants, but it doesn't come unhindered.
One example which is interesting is Japan. Japan has the most restrictive immigration policies of almost any country in the world. There is almost no one that can get into Japan if you're not Japanese. And Japan has been growing remarkably fast for 20 years. Up to 1990, but also it has stagnated remarkably since 1990. A lot of people do say that the lack of new ideas, new labor force, new competition from immigrants has been one of the causes. Japan is an aging society. Japan is a place where population growth is negative, and this can have an impact on growth.
It's not just about skill, though. Part of having something substantive in a new country is having something to call your own. For some, it's a house. To many, it's a business. Paul McDaniel is an Immigration Entrepreneurship and Innovation Fellow at the American Immigration Council, and he explains how people are getting there.
Immigrants are much more likely to be entrepreneurs than the native-born population, so they have a higher rate of starting businesses.
Walking through any Chinatown anywhere is really just proof of this.
The types of businesses that you see contributing to neighborhood revitalization and just the vitality of different neighborhoods in the city, like restaurants, retail, markets, these types of businesses that are very integral to neighborhood revitalization and vitality. Immigrants form a large percentage of those types of businesses. I think that one statistic shows that immigrants are at least twice as likely as native-born to start businesses.
From an entrepreneurial standpoint, then, some cities in the United States are highly welcoming.
There's a growing movement of cities around the U.S. that are choosing to implement strategies and policies and initiatives to be more welcoming to immigrants, and they recognize immigrants as one component, as contributing to one component of their broader economic growth, and so they're trying to attract more people to move to these places and start businesses and contribute to the local economy. So Nashville, Tennessee is one example, Detroit, Michigan, Chicago, Dayton, Ohio, Los Angeles. You see a big diversity of cities, but for one particular example in Nashville, they have been working to attract immigrants, and they're working with different community-based organizations in their city.
More often than not, what entrepreneurs really need is a guide of sorts to get them going, and people are beginning to recognize that.
One example is Connection Americas. They hold classes for immigrants in the language of the immigrant. Of the immigrant population to educate about how to go about starting a business in Nashville. What are the different things you need to think about when you're starting a business? What are the different permits and regulations you need to know about, and inspections depending on the different type of business? So they're very interested in supporting that.
Of course, starting a registered business is a privilege extended to legal citizens of a country. And many migrants in the U.S. don't fall within that category. Not even close. But that doesn't mean they aren't still contributing. Here's Professor Perry again.
The estimate is around 11.5 million. And by all means, they contribute a lot to the economy. So the employment rate among American undocumented is very high, is higher than among similar native worker. Most of them are Latin American, Mexican. Most of them have relatively low level of education, but they are almost all employed in those type of jobs that Americans are moving out of, construction, manual agricultural job, manual services.
And what about the accusation that they don't pay taxes because they're illegal?
They contribute because a lot of them really pay taxes. Some of them have this social security number, a fake one. They cannot have a real one, and they constantly contribute and money into it. They consume, they buy, and they do not have very much access to any of the welfare state transfer. And so they don't cost too much, actually, to the U.S. government. So, interestingly, they do contribute. They probably contribute much more than a similar American worker in terms of how much they pay in taxes and how little they take away in public assistance money.
Right, that's another point. Public assistance money, social welfare, another ongoing struggle in the larger American landscape.
America has been fighting a war on poverty since 1965, almost a half century ago. And it is a war that we are still losing. I repeat, losing. Federal and state governments spend just over $1 trillion a year. Means-tested welfare programs. $1 trillion. That doesn't include entitlement programs like Social Security or Medicare. The federal government's share of that $1 trillion is just about $750 billion, more than we actually spend in this country on our national defense, the Justice Department, transportation, education combined. What are we doing? Why doesn't somebody ask, what are we doing?
To understand that, we needed to meet someone else. Sybil Fox, sociology professor and author of Three Worlds of Relief, Race, Immigration, and the American Welfare State from the Progressive Era to the New Deal. Her work deals with how the welfare system has evolved to cope with different periods of immigration.
Blacks were largely excluded from social welfare services in the Progressive Era and the New Deal. European immigrants were included, especially Southern and Eastern Europeans. In some respects, they were treated better than native-born white populations. They had greater access to social welfare services. And Mexican immigrants were treated differently than both of these groups. They were more included than were African Americans, but they were also more likely to be expelled from the country for their use of relief. So local welfare offices in areas where there were large Mexican American populations would cooperate with the Immigration Service to deport anyone who came to the welfare office.
What she found, historically, was dispiriting to say the least.
Immigration status, even legal status, mattered very little. What mattered most was race and racism. So European immigrants, even if they were in the country illegally, generally had generous access to social welfare services. There were no federal restrictions on undocumented immigrants' access to Social Security or unemployment insurance, and no federal restrictions on their use of state welfare programs either. Mexicans were excluded, but not primarily because of their immigration or legal status, primarily because of the racial stereotypes that white Americans had of Mexicans. And so I think this is helpful for thinking about immigration policy today. One, to remind ourselves that it wasn't always this way. For 40 years, undocumented immigrants had access to the American social welfare system. And that we should be concerned about how and to what degree racism is influencing American social welfare policy today.
And if you're wondering what that means today, the answer is not good if you're an immigrant who understands that life has an uncanny way of striking you down.
Undocumented immigrants are barred from most federal welfare programs, so they're barred from Social Security and Medicare, unemployment insurance, TANF, food stamps, Medicaid, and the like. They're only eligible for some public health programs, emergency medical assistance, and a few programs that are focused on children, like the Head Start program or school breakfast and lunch program.
Professor Perry said earlier that illegal immigrants contribute greatly to taxes. Sybil has a rough idea of how great that contribution has been.
One estimate suggests that by 2007, undocumented immigrants had contributed up to $240 billion to the Social Security system. And these are benefits that they won't be able to take advantage of when they reach the age of 65. So they're contributing billions of dollars into both federal, state, and local taxes and getting very little from the government in return.
And what of accusations that immigrants hinder the redistribution of social welfare funds?
Early research suggested that this was the case, but new research is suggesting that there's very little evidence that the proportion of immigrants in a population, either across states or across countries, has any negative relationship with either voter support for social welfare spending or actual social welfare spending. To the extent that there's some sort of a trade-off between diversity and redistribution, it is often a question of trade-offs with native-born minority populations rather than immigrant populations. So in the United States, there is a lot of evidence that the more African-Americans in a state, the less social welfare spending there is. But there's very little evidence that the more Asian immigrants or Latino immigrants in a state, that there's less social welfare spending or less desire for social welfare spending. So it doesn't seem as if immigration decreases either support for redistribution or actual redistribution.
This is far from conclusive, but from the people we spoke to, the evidence that immigration is, on balance, good for the country's health is strong. It's an injection of hungry people with new ideas and the belief that they're bringing this hunger and this freshness to a place that welcomes it. The reality is, though, that they might be responding to mixed signals from a country famed for its friendliness. Next week, on The Pendatang Cometh, Pushback. You're listening to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.